Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and it is episode number 75. How crazy that might be. We're actually at episode number 75, talking about our 26th favorite movies of all time, which for John is Arrival. For me, I had 2001 A Space Odyssey. John has that higher, so instead we're talking about Interstellar. So if you're not a science fiction movie fan, don't listen to this podcast. You really got nothing going for you by sitting here and enduring this. If you were looking for last week's episode, I have no idea how it was live and fine, and then all of a sudden it just became unlisted. It is now public. I don't know why it was not public for a period of time, but it is public now. And we talked about Magnolia and The Witch. So go back, check that one out. But today we're talking Interstellar and Arrival. First time I've revisited Interstellar in quite a few years. John, I think it was the same for you, right?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it since it came out in theaters.
Mm-hmm. I think I saw maybe one time after theaters. Haven't seen Arrival since theaters, so that'll be fun to talk about as well. But yeah, two really good, I think two really great modern science fiction movies.
Yeah.
One of them replacing arguably the greatest science fiction movie of all time. But it, you know, I do think that there's something with like space travel, aliens, something like that, that as we've become like more of a technology heavy society has become more interesting again, because for a period of time there was just nothing interesting happening with science fiction movies aside from Armageddon, which is an all time great movie and probably top 10. And if I was being honest with myself, would probably be being discussed at this point. But it seems like something happened in the late 2000s that just really opened people's eyes to these things and made these really high concept, beautiful to look at movies that really get into like what it is to be human, what it is to have human emotion, what it is for the endurance of humanity that we just weren't getting from science fiction movies for a little while there. Science fiction movies were trying to be too smart for their own good. I do think that what a lot of the success of Arrival and Interstellar is based on is the fact that they're easily digestible, realistically. Interstellar is 3 hours long. Don't get me wrong. And Arrival is ultimately,
sure is.
Yeah. And Arrival is ultimately about language, which, you know, that might not seem digestible, but sometimes people, when they make science fiction, it's kind of like with horror, they just try to be almost like aloof. I know that's not the right word, but that's how it feels sometimes. And it just gets out of control. And these are two movies that are pretty straightforward for everything that they try to accomplish.
Yeah. I mean, it goes without saying, these are the two best science fiction movies of the last decade, probably even longer, maybe even like the last like 30 years. Like that, that's how good these two movies are in comparison to the other science fiction movies that are out there lately. And I think a lot of it comes down, like you said, it is very digestible. It's easy content to get into, but I think it's digestible because both Nolan and Villeneuve both understand like tropes of science fiction that make them accessible. Because if we're looking at Interstellar, there's a lot of heavy science in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
If we're looking at Arrival, there's a lot of like heavy linguistics in that movie. Like these are topics like that are very specific, but they're presented in a way where it's very understandable and very easy and accessible.
Yeah, let's start with Interstellar since it's not actually on either of our lists, and then we'll go to Arrival since that is your actual number 26. But my thing with Interstellar is this. I loved this movie when it came out. I personally think 2014 is one of the worst years for movies in the last decade. I know we have Birdman next week, which was on your list. Whiplash was on my list. Aside from those two movies, I didn't really care for much at all that year, except for Interstellar. And so now I got to look that up to make sure I actually believe that. But my thing was when Interstellar came out, I was really surprised that like it got like a lukewarm reception. And it was coming 4 years on the heels of Inception. It was coming, I think it was what, 2 years on the heels of the final Dark Knight Rises movie. And I think people had cooled on Nolan because of the Dark Knight Rises. They weren't happy with how that franchise ended. They weren't happy with like really like what he did there. They thought there should have been more to it, especially off the success of The Dark Knight. And it just kind of led, I think it has like a 73% of Rotten Tomatoes. I think that's like absolute insanity at this point. I think this is one of the most visually stunning movies of all time. I think that the storyline is great. The acting is great. I love that it's going to the different planets. I love the third act of this movie. I think the third act is very interesting. And like, it just would blow my mind when you'd read reviews about this movie that were like, I couldn't understand what the people were saying. That is like the most obnoxious Nolan critique, which I agree with on a movie like Tenet. Tenet was just nonsense, garbled, whatever. But this was coming on the heels of Bane, and people were starting to complain about that kind of thing. Michael Caine's dying words aren't hard to understand because of the music. They're hard to understand because Michael Caine is dying. And because, and you get the point. Like, it's all there. Yeah. The rest of this movie, the sound design, the score by Hans Zimmer is absolutely epic. And I just love what this movie accomplishes. I think it came out at the wrong time for him, because then all of a sudden Dunkirk comes out and everybody jumps all over and, oh my God, Nolan is amazing again and blah, blah, blah. And I personally think Dunkirk stinks. I was so bored by Dunkirk. It's crazy. I love the questions that are asked in Interstellar. I love how it really gets into the largeness of everything in this world. I'm totally fine with any of the coincidence and things like that happen. I like that we have in the first act all of this weird stuff happening, and it's actually just Matthew McConaughey now living in this place where time is the fifth dimension. It's an actual physical construct, which we'll talk about more with Arrival, because that's something that they talk about in that too. But I just love this movie, and I love the clear inspiration from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I say this, I throw these words around, and I don't mean this in terms of they're as good. I just mean this because of what they are. I believe that Interstellar is our generation's 2001 A Space Odyssey, and I believe that The Revenant is our generation's Lawrence of Arabia. And my reasons for that are the scope, the massiveness, what they're going for, and they're modernizing it for today's audience. 2001 A Space Odyssey is something that cinephiles love, that we can really get behind. But most people are going to sit down in 2022, watch that movie and go, what the hell was that? That was stupid. I don't want to watch that anymore. Interstellar, yeah, it's 3 hours long, but it's much more easily digested. I think it's our generation Space Odyssey. I think it's a phenomenal movie with great acting and a storyline. Not for nothing, I love Space Odyssey. It's my number 26. The storyline to Interstellar is so much more easily followable, and it's funny because there would be reviews that were like, this was nonsense, it made no sense. It makes a lot more sense than a lot of science fiction movies out there. And I like you said earlier, John, it makes it so that the science is easy to understand, and that's not an easy thing to pull off in a movie.
No, it's not, especially with a movie of the scope of Interstellar, because it's dealing with a lot of like quantum physics and time questions are always weird. I know, because time travel science fiction is like one of my favorite genres of all time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see Lost on my TV right now because that's one of my favorite shows of all time. We're talking two time travel movies this week. I love it, but it's so complicated because there's so many different theories about time travel, how it works, everything like that, that it's hard to present it in a way where you can go like the Primer route, where you explain it in such scientific detail that you lose audiences, or you can kind of go a simpler route, like something like the time machine, right? Just like the H.G. Wells time machine of like, hey, look, you're in a different time now. Mm-hmm. And what Interstellar does is it presents it as this manipulation of dimensional space. And like, yeah, the third act with the Tesseract and everything is confusing if you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. But as long as you're paying attention, it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. It's all explained very, very straightforward by Thomas.
Almost overly explained.
Yeah, like there's almost too much exposition in that point. But I love these little bits. I love the science. I love, the time stretching as you're closer and the gravitational pull is closer towards this black hole. Like, that's a very interesting segment. It changes the way you perceive this movie, because it changes your perception of time and how things are passing and interacting with each other. It's fascinating because of that, in my opinion. And yeah, I remember seeing Interstellar when it came out and was like, it was good. I didn't think anything very special of it. I texted you while watching it this time. I was like, man, this movie's a lot better than I remember it being. Because the first half of this movie, absolutely incredible. The second act of this movie sucks so much. Everything with Matt Damon terrible.
See, it's so funny because I totally disagree. And I'm excited to talk about that because Matt Damon is a big knock on this movie. And I saw your review, and that's something that is a big knock, but it never bothered me. But I'll let you keep going because we'll talk about that.
I didn't realize it bothered me until rewatching it this time. And I what bothers me about it and why I don't think Interstellar, yes, do I agree that Interstellar is like this generation's space epic, like 2001: A Space Odyssey? Absolutely. There's no comparison other than this. It's the only movie that has the same scope as that film. I think that this movie can't reach that because it doesn't have the same symbolism that 2001 has. And I think the biggest blight on this movie is this introduction of a human antagonist in the second act. Where I get what Nolan's doing. I get that he's presenting this idea of like human preservation and the idea of the ego taking over, and Matt Damon's or man's man, as in the scientist, not like man, like humans, but man, the scientist, and his desire to live being so much more than like wanting to preserve the human race. Like, I get the aspect that he's going for here. I just wish it wasn't an introduction of another character, and I wish we just focused more on the characters we had already been introduced to at this point.
See, what I like about this, so we kind of texted a little bit back and forth about this, but I feel like 2001: A Space Odyssey is about like what's coming next for humanity. Where is humanity going in the grand scheme of like, it's like the proverbial they, you know, it's like, where are humans going? Not what planet or this, but like, what's the supernova baby or whatever it's called at the end of the movie? Like that kind of thing is just so, that's the evolution of man and going through the room and everything at the end. Interstellar to me is just about man and not so much their need for new and creating and things like that. But like you said there, preservation, human preservation. Like this is about what, to me, Interstellar is a science fiction movie that is about what does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
And I'm going to take you on a journey literally across galaxies to teach you what it means to be human. And I think there's this innate desire in human beings to be the hero, to be something more than what they actually are. I think that's why we love movies like, you know, Indiana Jones and Star Wars and things like that. Because at the end of the day, we sit here, we sit and do this podcast. This might be the most significant thing I ever do in my entire life. Yeah. And I kind of need to be okay with that, but it'd be nice to be a hero at some point, right? And I think that what this movie is doing is it's saying, here's these 12 people who went off to these distant planets because they were going to be the hero. And the reason why Matt Damon's character is so important to this story is because he was the ultimate hero. He was the one who put this whole thing together and said, we just need to go, we need to do it, and we need to make it happen. But you see it all the time. Your action hero, your leader, that doesn't mean that they're the actual hero when push comes to shove. And Matt Damon knew that all he had to do was push that button and he would be saved. And that's humanity. How do you sit there and let yourself drown if you're underwater and have the ability to swim? You don't. You can't do it. Like, you just have that desire to pick your head up from underwater that makes you pick your head up from underwater. That is what this movie, like, that's what his character is doing. And it's in a bigger thing. But here's a guy who knew the people weren't getting off Earth, knew that he had a 1 in 12 chance of not, or had an 11 in 12 chance of not being the person selected, pretty much, going to the right planet, thinks he's going to be okay with that, and then becomes so selfish in the last moment that his preservation of himself is more important than the actual preservation of the rest of the crew and wherever humanity is going to go next. Because even though you can say it's for humanity, it's for humanity, it's for humanity, at the end of the day, when I die, I don't really know what's going on after that. You know, I don't know what's going on. And that's why human preservation, your singular preservation is so big. That's why I think this is important, because we are watching a mission that is all about trying to preserve everybody else. They know Anne Hathaway, and Matthew McConaughey know they're losing out on time with their families and that things are going to be messed up, that they might never come back. But they're willing to do it because it's the only way to save the people they care about. Yeah. And here's Matt Damon's character who's only concerned about saving himself after he was the one who thought that he was going to go out there and save the human race.
Yeah, and I do really like that characterization. I love what they do with Matt Damon's character here. I just don't love the inclusion of his character. Like that, that's the thing with me. It's like, if you're going to include this character, this is the best way to do it. It gets a point across. It really does. Ultimately, like, one of the major themes about this is that our perseverance is driven by love. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's what gives us the power to persevere through anything. Mm-hmm. And it's the major theme of this film. And it's conflicted when Brand wants to go to Edmund's world, mm-hmm. which, I mean, at the end of the movie, is the correct planet to go to.
Yeah.
But when she wants to go to Edmund's world because she loved Edmund's, and then the decision is, okay, we have to go to Man's because Man's is the one that makes more sense because this one's the one that's continually broadcasting. So we know that it's still there. And it's that dichotomy of love and instinct versus logic and all that. And that's where this really comes to is like, that's why I don't like this, because like it feels so in this movie that's so much about science. It's the irrational love that's correct and not the rational side, and that bugs me in the movie.
See, I think what doesn't bug me about that is I think what the ultimate statement on this movie is that love is the only thing that really separates humans from everything else. And like,
yeah, I didn't get that.
And I think that's where it doesn't really bother. Look, whenever people start, well, I'm going to define love for you in a movie, I always just like kind of roll my eyes. I mean, you know, the only person who ever defined love appropriately was Charlie Kaufman. So like, he's the only one who ever figured it out and that's it. But I feel like in this movie, like when Anne Hathaway is giving her speech and everything, that was another thing that got kind of ripped. And you gotta think too, Interstellar, this is an aside, but Interstellar had so much working against it because somehow people had determined in their minds that Anne Hathaway was a shit actress because she won Best Supporting Actress for being in 5 minutes of a movie when she gives one of the best performances of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
People had determined that she now sucked. People had determined McConaughey sucked because he was too good. He was too big. Like, it just wasn't going to live up to the expectations. There was so much working against this movie when it first came out. But now you have Anne Hathaway giving that speech, and it was an immediate thing for critics to be like, ha, I told you she sucks. Yeah, she's the worst. And it's like, or it's just like, that's what the movie, that's the theme of the movie. And yeah. I do agree that like probably the weakest part of Interstellar is that logic, like is that thing. But I also like that realistically, the being who put together the black hole was Matthew McConaughey and TARS. They were doing that by just like essentially, you know, creating chaos. They create this black hole. And Matthew McConaughey was trying to get himself to think logically and know that the planet really close to the black hole isn't going to be survivable. And that's the conversation they're having is we cannot survive on a planet this close to the black hole. Eventually, it's going to get sucked into the gravitational pull. So really, Edmonds was the best choice, even though she was basing it on love. And it's almost like McConaughey had to go against that even more. Because you can't just base it solely on love. And he's going through that conflict as well, where he has to spend more time on the planets and he has to do all these different things. And it almost kind of feels like he wants to get back at her in a little bit of a way, because another really big human emotion is just anger and revenge. Like, that's a desire for humans. And even though he might not instinctively know that, he knows he just missed out on whatever they say, 20 years or 25 years, whatever it is. He has to go back and look at his kids. Now he's got to turn around and it's like, oh, well, we're going to do what's best for her. And it's very weird, but it's like he's not thinking logically either. And I think, you know, that ultimately leads to him just going the wrong way.
Right. And then it leads to Matthew McConaughey's character is actually really good in this movie. And anyone who tells you otherwise is just not paying attention to this character arc at all. Because he's such a family man that the reason he's doing this, the reason he's sacrificing time with his children, is to preserve their life. Everything he is doing is because of those two people in his life. Mm-hmm. And when we get to this point and we have Bran's speech and everything, and then Bran confronts him about your fuel calculations are based on a return trip. Like, yeah. If this planet doesn't work, are you willing to do the noble thing to sacrifice to get to this other planet? And in the end, like, ultimately, that is what he does. He doesn't just sacrifice, like, his return trip. He sacrifices his life for all he knows. He enters mm-hmm. a black hole in order to ensure that Bran can take the many fertilized eggs to this planet and continue the human race.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great story arc for this character, almost ruined by the fact that he survives everything and does get to see his family again at the end. But
I think it's fine. Yeah, and I think the fact that he's seeing them, like, and he's not a part of it, I think is what's important there. Like,
I agree.
He sees his daughter. He never sees his son again, but he sees his daughter, and now she's old and she's got all her family around. And granted, they all came from him. That's his bloodline there. Yeah. But none of them even know who he is, essentially. You know, like, he doesn't exist.
Yeah, other than through legend, essentially, at that point.
Yep.
I mean, I love the ending of the movie when he wakes up and they're like, you're on Cooper Station. And he's like, oh, that's really sweet of you to name it after me. It's like, no, man, not named after you. It's named after your daughter.
Yeah.
And like, him seeing Murph there right before she dies, and then having hers being like, I have my family here for this. You need to go do what you need to do, which is finish the mission. Mm-hmm. And like, it always threw me off. Like, the first time I saw this movie kind of threw me off. Then I realized that because he was in the black hole and because they went through Gargantuan's gravitational pull, this was explained. It was all explained. Mm-hmm. Bran arriving on that planet probably happened simultaneously with him being on Cooper Station.
Yeah.
Like the timeline works if you think about it hard enough.
Yeah.
And again, that's what this film does really well. It does that stuff really well. But honestly, I feel the best parts of this movie are all the character parts. I love the relationship between Matthew McConaughey and Murph, like, at the very beginning of the film. It's fantastic to see that love that he has for both of his kids. Timothy Chalamet's in this movie, which I totally forgot. Also, it was one of those moments where it was like, is that Timothy Chalamet? Because you couldn't quite tell because he was like just hitting puberty at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I love that connection. I love his relationship with like John Lithgow's character is great. And then you see that relationship develop with like Murph and Michael Caine's character, as like Jessica Chastain takes over the role of Murph, and you have the messages from Casey Affleck. Casey Affleck, who like hasn't seen his father in decades at this point, still sending messages to him, like informing him of his life and everything. Those are the moments I really love in Interstellar, and I wish we got more of them from the people on this mission.
Yeah, I agree with that. Wes Bentley is a very minor character in this, despite and then what is it? David Giassi, he's a very small character, and like, they're both pretty small. Like, they don't have their big moments. Like, Giassi really just has his moments of like, he's losing it, and then when he has to go and it's like 23 years or whatever it is, and he's just like completely like lost his mind. Like, it's great acting, but that's really all it is. I do agree, but I think the problem is, and where I don't hate it, is this isn't a crew. This is a crew that has to be together for a while. I mean, it's like 2 years or whatever before they get to Saturn or go through the black hole or whatever it is. However, their main issue is not each other. And that's why you're not getting the human moments between each other, because they don't really give a crap about each other. They are mostly focused on, they care about each other, but they don't care. And I think that's a false knock on this movie, is that at the end, Matthew McConaughey is going to save Anne Hathaway out of love. I don't think that's true. I think he's going to save Anne Hathaway out of necessity, because that's another human thing. And he's going to go, and that's going to be what he knows. Okay, she's still out there. She's alive. I need to go make sure she's good, because there's no place for me here.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's him making the decision to continue the mission again, right? Like, he accomplished his own personal mission, which was to get back to see his daughter. And now he has to go continue the mission that he signed up for in the first place. The other things like I really love about this movie, I love that NASA has to be secret. I love that we're not told what happens on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
That we're not told why is all the vegetation dying. There are no animals anymore. Like, what's happening? I think it's set up really well. I like, even in like those opening moments of the film where we're seeing like the production companies,
mm-hmm.
and it's all in sepia tone and everything. It sets the mood for this dust bowl that that Earth is experiencing. We see the blight. I love Michael Caine's discussion of how blight thrives in a nitrogen-rich environment, which is why it's just going to kill off the human race. I love all of that. I like seeing that everyone just turns to being a farmer in this essentially post-apocalyptic world, where it's not the post-apocalyptic world we've seen in years preceding this, where it's all, you know, yes, it has sepia tone still, but it's not, you know, leather-clad people murdering each other all the time.
Yeah. It's right? Like the world hasn't evolved into Mad Max yet.
Yeah, and I think one of the most powerful moments of this film is when Coop's sitting down for the parent-teacher interview, and the teacher denies that man ever landed on the moon.
Mm.
Like, I think that is one of the greatest world-building scenes in any film. To have, like, two sentences explain the extent of what is happening in this world,
mm-hmm.
that people are denying space travel at this point. And then, especially in a movie that we know is called Interstellar, we know it's about space travel. But to have that line in this movie is just so powerful to show why NASA has to be in hiding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's not worth worrying about what's out there. We need to provide food, you know, like we can't be worried about all that. Yeah. It's, I mean, there's so many themes and there's a lot of depth to this movie. And I just, you know, I just appreciate so much. Like, to me, this is the movie where like Nolan really went for it. And I talked about this with Magnolia last week, where like, sometimes you just have to respect the ambition, and the ambition behind Interstellar is just, it's huge. Like, he was going for it. I think he had his best theming in this, and his you know, this was everything working together, the visuals, his directing style, his storytelling, his, you know, dialogue, which a lot of people knock, but like, this is some of his better, I think, just because it is sciency. But I think this was just everything clicking, and I think it works. And I see like the Letterboxd reviews and everything, and it looks like it worked for a lot of people, even though it is Nolan, so it's always going to get a little bit more credit than it probably deserves. Every movie of his does, but I don't know. I think Interstellar is like, I think it's an absolutely breathtaking science fiction movie.
I agree. I think it's in contention for one of Nolan's best, and I think it's like really close. I was saying that at the beginning of this film when I was rewatching it. I was like, is this Nolan's best movie? And as it went on, I decided, no, it wasn't. But Nolan demonstrated that he really understands what he was trying to say in this film.
Yeah,
go ahead. I even remember, like, at the time, Neil deGrasse Tyson was big because he was doing that show that everyone was watching at the time. And he pretty much critiqued every single science fiction movie that came out and the science presented in it. And even he said, like, the theories presented in this film, while not 100% correct, are pretty damn close.
Yeah. And that was something people wanted to nitpick this movie for, like, not being accurate. It's like, okay, have you been to a black hole? What was it like? Tell me what it was really like.
This is
how wormholes
work. This is correct. Yeah. In theory, like, we don't know because we've never seen them.
Yeah. Tell me what Matt Damon's planet was really like, since you know better, Mr. Reviewer. I always have this as my third favorite. This one has snuck into top hundreds in the past. It won't anytime soon, I don't think. But this is my third favorite behind Dark Knight and Memento. And I could enjoy it more than Dark Knight. I'd probably have to sit down and watch them side by side and figure that out. But John, before we jump into your movie, I didn't watch anything this week other than these two movies. I've been having a hard time, but I do want to apologize to 2014 first, because we kind of butchered that. The Oscars weren't very good that year, but they had Grand Budapest Hotel, Whiplash, Interstellar. Gone Girl, which I think is a great movie. Nightcrawler, yeah. Which is Jake Gyllenhaal at his weirdest. John Wick, the first one came out. Birdman. It Follows was that year. So right. that was a really good one. Dawn for the Planet of the Apes, which is probably the best of the Planet of the Apes other than the OG. Wild Tales was that year, which you haven't watched yet, but you will soon. So there were quite a few good movies. It's just like The Theory of Everything, Selma, Boyhood is probably
the Oscars just ignored them all.
Yeah, most overrated movie. So like, you know, it is, and I still like Boyhood, but it just didn't do it for me. Anyway, John, what was the best thing you watched this week? And I'm so excited to hear what it is because I looked at your reviews for this week and I'm freaking stoked. Let's go.
Okay. I this was a movie that I was considering putting in my top 100 the entire time. And then I was like, no, you know what? It's not that good. And I rewatched it in the last year and a half. And I was like, okay, this movie's really good. But like, is it a top 100 movie? And rewatching it again this week, I was like, no, this is definitely a top 100 movie. This is one of my favorite movies of all times. It's 1999's The Mummy. It is just an instant classic. It is the pinnacle of the action adventure genre, in my opinion. I said it in my Letterboxd review. This is what Indiana Jones wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Like, this is just, it's so good. The cast has incredible chemistry. Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz, John Hannah, all absolutely fantastic in this movie. It has this incredible blend of action, adventure, comedy, horror. I saw this movie in theaters when it came out in 1999. This movie gave me nightmares for years. And then I finally revisited it at probably 4 or 5 years later and realized that those fears were completely unwarranted. This movie is absolutely incredible. It is probably the best popcorn picture ever. It is just so fantastic, so fun. I don't know anyone who just straight dislikes this movie.
Yeah, I love The Mummy. This is like one of my go-tos whenever it's like guilty pleasure kind of thing, even though like Armageddon's my guilty pleasure. Like Armageddon's my, yes, this is a terrible movie, but you better believe I know every line in that freaking movie. But with The Mummy, like, it's kind of interesting that it didn't build it. It has like a cult following. It has a big following. Mm-hmm. It made a lot of money. It was, you know, all those good things, but it almost kind of ruined the genre because then The Mummy Returns is trash. The Scorpion King stuff at the end, there's so much going on with that. It's just such a bad movie. And we never really saw another like really good movie like this again. That was also a blockbuster. This is such a fun action movie. It's one of my favorite action movies. It's just like, you can sit down. It's mind numbing, but it has everything you look for in these action adventure movies. You know, they're on the hunt for stuff, the figuring out like these little passageways. It's got the fun side characters and the good villain. I mean, this mummy is probably like the most popular mummy at this point, right? Like,
oh yeah. If we're like counting like all the way back to like Universal's like
Boris Karloff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably. I would say so. Like,
yeah,
Imhotep is just such an imposing villain. Mm-hmm. Like he's performed in such a way where he's so imposing, even in The Mummy Returns, which is a far inferior film to the original. Yeah. Like he's still so imposing in it. He's fantastic. And that's part of the reason why like the third movie in this franchise didn't work. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't have that as a character anymore. And it didn't have the same, I mean, it also didn't have Rachel Weisz in it. So
yeah,
take that as we will. But this movie, it does have this cult following. And I think with Brendan Fraser coming back into notoriety now with like his, he's in Darren Aronofsky's film that's coming out in a few months.
Yep.
That's getting a ton of praise. I hope more people rediscover this movie because it's just so fun.
It is. It is such a fun one. But all right, John, start talking about Arrival.
Arrival is a movie that I didn't watch in 2016 when it came out. I was up in the middle of nowhere by that point. So it took me a couple of years to watch it. And then I finally did. And fun fact, I'm a huge language nerd. I love linguistics. I love learning about languages. So this is exactly the type of movie that just draws my attention because it's a time travel science fiction movie that has to do with language. Sign me up. I am all on board. And I think Denis Villeneuve is one of the greatest acting directors now. I think he has this vision and understanding of the human condition that many people lack. And you see it in all his different films. He has such a wide array of films that he's made at this point, and they all just speak to mankind and humans and just everything about them. It reflects on it. This movie has that theme of love in it, and it's far more tragic than Interstellar when it comes to that. It has the time travel, but it's in a different conceit, where in Interstellar we have Cooper telling himself the coordinates for NASA so that he goes there and like can save humankind. And in this case, yes, there is a saving of humankind that happens with Amy Adams' character. But at the same time, it's like she's making this massive personal sacrifice, just like Coop did in Interstellar. But she's bringing other people into her sacrifice. And it's just so... I was weeping at the end of this movie. It's emotional. It's fascinating. As long as you're into linguistics, I understand why people wouldn't like this movie, but I absolutely love it.
Yeah, I always say, like, in order to subvert a trope, you have to hammer home the trope. And like the voiceover at the beginning with, I thought this was the beginning of your story, and then it was something else and blah blah blah, you're like, oh, okay, so like her daughter died, she's now depressed, she's divorced, whatever, when in reality all of this is taking place prior to any of that stuff happening. But it's subverting that expectation. It knows the tropes, it knows our expectations, and it's saying, boop, there we go, we're gonna go this way instead. My biggest knock on her, I like this so much more than the first time I saw it. I liked it the first time I saw it, but I didn't love it. I didn't get the hype. Yeah. And that might have been misplaced expectations. I'm expecting Interstellar because I loved Interstellar 2 years before. Now Arrival comes out, it's going to win all these Oscars, be nominated for all this stuff, and just didn't do it for me.
I can't believe it didn't win anything.
Yeah.
Well, I can, because 2016 is a very, very good year in film, but I get it.
And my thing was, with this movie, and it hit me again this time, it's very emotional. It gets to that, like, that level. I just wish that the purpose of the aliens landing was a little bit more described, or like, what did the aliens have to offer humanity? I think
okay.
Go ahead.
I can explain that completely because it's very much in the movie.
Yeah, go ahead. No, but go ahead, because I'm going to give my reasoning why I don't like what you're about to say. So go ahead.
Okay. So they explain that they come to humanity in order to provide them this tool that allows them to see the future, and in order to unite humanity. Like, that's the entire purpose, is to unite humanity, because in 3,000 years, their race is going to need humanity to save them. Mm-hmm. I think that's brilliant. I think that's great. And I love the like 1/12th of it all. And like the fact that like they come in 12, because there's that point in early on in the film where they say, if this is peaceful first contact, why did they send 12 and not one?
Yeah.
And then that like realization that it's because this is the only way humanity can all work together and unite as one. I love it. I think it's brilliant. But why don't you?
Well, so like, I appreciate all that. I guess it just feels the way in which it is presented, I guess, is what is more of my knock. Not so much what it is presenting, but like, you know, at the end of the day, the easiest thing like would be like, here's the cure for cancer. Like, we know that, and we're here to come and do whatever. I really love the twist and how the twist is handled at the end. I love the way that it's like, who is this little girl? Like, that's such a great moment. And like, you know, it gives you chills and everything. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I just think like, by them being like, well, we're giving you this tool, and now everybody's going to see the future and whatever, I just guess like the payoff didn't feel like it did anything for me in that moment. Cause then she goes, she talks to the president of China, and that's it. Like, then it's over. And then it goes back to her human element. And like, I'm all about small stories on big scope. I mean, Interstellar is kind of a small story on a big scope.
Yeah.
I just wish that like, there was more to it than like, oh, Amy Adams could do it. Because what we pretty much hear is Jeremy Renner never really gets to that point, and Jeremy Renner can't handle it. And when she tells him, Jeremy Renner kind of loses it, because Jeremy Renner doesn't really get this tool, I guess, is one way to describe it. So I just wish that like, okay, Amy Adams has this, but she also had direct contact with these aliens. and maybe the president of China has it, but what is like, so for the next 3,000 years, humanity is just like living like without like a space time continuum. And then they just go and they help this race in 3,000. Like, I guess that's just where like my head, I just wish there was something more to it. I don't know. I just something more that's actually in the movie.
Right.
Might've done more for me. I still really like this movie, but that's just where I'm at with that.
See, I find one of the most fascinating things about Mankind, and we kind of talked about this with like District 12 or District 9 and stuff, is one of the most fascinating things when you think about humankind and just the way our world is shaped. Science fiction has addressed this topic many times, but a grand unification of Earth is almost impossible without first contact. It is impossible without there being a uniting factor to unite against.
Yeah, because we just saw what happened with COVID. It didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, COVID should have done that, but it didn't. And if that's the case, like, it has to be an existential threat that is imposing on Earth that will destroy all of humankind. Literally, the theme of Interstellar. And I think Arrival is doing it in a way where it's like, I love the contrast between the scientific approach to first contact and the militaristic approach to first contact. And you see it in these characters. I love that, like, there is this group of people who are paying so much attention to, like, the internet, essentially, that they're becoming radical and they want to set a bomb off in this spaceship and just deal with it. And that's completely the wrong approach to this situation. And I love that they misinterpret essentially tool as the word weapon. Those are those things. I love the conversation about
kangaroo.
How, I mean, yes, that is a fantastic scene. She's explaining, like, Louise is explaining that situation. I'm like, this story is not true, is it? And I'm like Googling it as she says, nah, I made it all up. So that proves my point. And I'm like, yes, it does. I also love the idea of China using Mahjong to communicate with them. And in doing so, it's creating an adversarial dialect between them because it's always about conflict. Those are the little details in this movie that I think put it from, in my opinion, put it above Interstellar.
Yeah. No, and I do think that, like, I think both of these movies offer so much on multiple viewings and everything like that, that I have a hard time saying Arrival offers more. I think it really does come down to preference. And I think that's what's so interesting about talking about these two movies at the same time and putting them in there with the same, with Space Odyssey as well, because Space Odyssey was supposed to be my movie. These three movies could not be any more different and they could not be any more similar. Like, they have so much in common, their theming, what they're about, the visuals, all of that. And yet they all are so different in their approach to the subject matter. Arrival does language, Interstellar goes through, you know, what it means pretty much to be human. And then 2001 A Space Odyssey is just about, like, what else is out there and who is giving us the tools. And really, Arrival, you can clearly see where the inspiration comes from, because the tools, you're getting the tools. I mean, that is what Space Odyssey is doing, the tool to come up with the bone to kill people and to do space travel and all that fun stuff. I love all those small moments too. And I think that's why this moved up so much for me, because I think on a first viewing, I missed so much of that. Or even if I didn't miss it, I was just kind of like, I was just let down by the entire experience of watching this movie. But especially now, and like now, like I'm at the point where, like, I went and got an MFA in creative writing, where you have all these people who, like, you know, they're doing everything they can to write about language and things like that. And to be around them, and this is not a knock on them, but then to see an expert really pull this off, wow. Like, it is so impressive that this movie really isn't even science fiction, if you think about it, because if they took out, like all that makes this movie science fiction is that she's talking to aliens. Like, these things landed and now she's talking to aliens. Like, that's it. That's all there is to this. Like, that is,
I mean, there's
like,
also the time travel aspect.
Well, there's the time travel, but that we don't realize that there's time travel until the end of the movie too. But like, if you had sat down and said, well, the premise of my sci-fi movie is she sits around and talks to aliens the whole time. That sounds pretty friggin' boring. I mean, that sounds really, really, really boring. There's science fiction generally, and you had mentioned Primer earlier, so throw Primer out because those types of science fiction are different. But science fiction generally is less on story, more on scope, yeah. If you really think about it. Arrival is more on story, less on scope. And it takes the talented hand of your Canadian man, who I can never pronounce his name. Yeah, it takes the talented hand of him to be able to pull off something like this. Also, working with three of the best actors working in Hollywood, with Forrest Whitaker, really four of them, because Michael Stuhlbarg is just one of the most underrated actors ever.
Yeah.
But Stuhlbarg, Forrest Whitaker, Jeremy Renner, Amy Adams, it's going to help your movie. And it's a good thing that they had such talented people attached to this movie, because if they didn't, this is a bad movie. But that just goes to show, like, in the right hands, you get a masterpiece as opposed to, you know, what could have been a pile of shit.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned Jeremy Renner, because I love Jeremy Renner as the scientist type more than any other role he plays in a movie.
Couldn't agree more. He is not an action hero.
He's not an action hero, but he's so fitted for this type of role. I think his performance in this is incredible. Amy Adams is spectacular. It's baffling that she doesn't get a nomination for this performance, in my opinion. But then again, Arrival wasn't nominated for Best Picture, was it?
No, it was. Arrival was nominated for Best Picture.
But yeah, I mean, you're up against... There were a lot of very popular movies that year.
Yeah, that was a tough year. Let me just make sure that I'm in the right year here.
That was the Moonlight. That's Moonlight. That's La La Land.
Yeah, it's a tough year. Manchester by the Sea, Hell or High Water, yeah. Nocturnal Animals.
It's a tough year.
If you look at Best Picture that year, it was Moonlight, Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hell or High Water, Hidden Figures, which is the worst by far out of this bunch, La La Land, Lion, and Manchester by the Sea. Personally, I love all of those movies except for Hidden Figures. Lion and Moonlight are probably like the two that I'd have the lowest out of that bunch. And that's not even getting into the fact, like I just said, Nocturnal Animals came out that year, and that movie is like not even incredible.
Yeah. We talked about that
Jackie was that year. Like, there's a lot of good movies that year.
Yeah, it is a tough year, so it's understandable. But I think, low-key, one of the greatest things about this entire thing, Johan Johansson's score in this film. Yeah,
great score.
It's one of the best science fiction scores of all time. It perfectly sets every single scene. It's incredible. It's haunting. It's eerie. It's just a fantastic score. And I really like seeing this and contrasting it to Hans Zimmer's score for Interstellar, which I'm lower on than most people. I feel like Hans Zimmer was really going for like the Richard Strauss thing to like emulate 2001: A Space Odyssey rather than make his own thing for the most part. I think the score works in the film quite well, but I don't think it's as masterfully crafted as the Johansson score.
Well, I think the difference between the two is, again, I think it's just what the movies are. Interstellar is this, we're going on an adventure to save humanity movie. That needs an epic score. That needs like your boom, like, you know, whatever. And it's not quite Inception, Interstellar, but in terms of score. But Arrival is a more subdued score, and it's more of like a depressing, like introspective kind of score. But I think it works the whole time. You know what I mean? Like I think both scores work for what their movies are. But yeah, Arrivals is haunting. And I think it makes sense because Arrival is set up much more as a mystery movie, whereas Interstellar is set up much more as an action movie. Arrival is like, what is this thing that's happening? And it's Arrival almost feels like a character study within a character study within a science fiction movie within, like, it's really interesting how it's done, and that's going to require different scoring for sure.
And I love, there's so much setup in this movie. And one thing I didn't mention with Interstellar is I love the ghost is so prevalent in the first act that you know it comes back later in the film.
Yeah.
Then something. Arrival has you thinking about time in that opening monologue, like that opening voiceover. It mentions time a couple of times to make you like think about it, and then blindsides you with the twist later on in the film.
Yep. And why is that?
What do you mean?
Well, why does it, why can it say all that stuff and you just totally disregard it and the twist still work?
Because it's looking, because when you're thinking about time in this case, in this opening monologue or the opening voiceover, you think it's introspective and and a retrospective. But you then realize that it's not a retrospective. It's the future. And that's the point where the reason why this twist is so effective is because it all makes sense. You never see the father, so you have no idea Jeremy Renner until after the revelation. But there are hints throughout the entire, all of these scenes have hints as to what's going on, that this is the future. You have the dimensions of time. You have the, oh, if it's a question about science, ask your father.
Yeah.
Like it's these little things. And then we get that moment, the non-zero sum game moment.
Yeah.
You're like, that's weird. Like, you just remember this point. And it's like,
and it's because she's living in both places at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. It's so, it's set up so well.
And here's what I was going to get at with this. One of my biggest complaints when I was working in film or doing, you know, my MFA, all that stuff, is when somebody would do something and people would be, oh, that's cliche. We've seen that before. We've done, oh no, that's stupid, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like, we see this on Rotten Tomatoes a lot when a TV show comes out. House of Dragons sucks. Well, you've watched one episode. How do you know that the whole show through 9 seasons is going to suck? You don't, because you don't know the whole story. This opening monologue, if this came from John Millsap and it was put on the desk of somebody, they would say, seen it before, don't care.
Yeah.
That's why it works so well, though, because they tell you everything about this movie in that first opening monologue, and you disregard it and ignore it because we've seen flashbacks to a woman who had a hard time because her daughter died of some rare disease, and oh, now she's trying to figure out how to get on with her life. We've seen it a million times. That's not what it is, though. And that's when you're in the hands of like a really skilled writer and a really skilled director, is when you can just subvert those expectations.
There are even little things like this film doesn't leave anything up to, like, there are films where you kind of have to assume what's going on. The film where the scene where Forrest Whitaker comes into the office establishes why Amy Adams' character is the one being selected for this. It's because she worked for the FBI previously, so she already has security clearance. It makes sense, and that's what I love about Villeneuve's films in general. Like, they all work like this for the most part. And Villeneuve makes a reference to himself in this movie. Did you catch that? I don't know what you want about that. So the moment where another great scene in this film is the dream scene where Jeremy Renner's talking to Amy Adams and talking about, like, this idea of comprehending language and thinking in a different language and stuff like that, trying to rework your brain. And he asks, are you dreaming in English? And then the haptopods in the corner.
Yeah.
That is definitely a direct reference to Enemy.
I've never actually seen Enemy.
Oh, well, you should see Enemy, because definitely feels like a direct reference to that film.
Yeah. Haven't seen it. So there you go. That's why I didn't realize that he was making a direct reference. But yeah, I mean, the dream sequences that you can't really tell if they're dreams or if she's just living in this other time and like being able to be in two places at once, and like why that makes it where she's okay with like what's going to happen with her daughter, because she's like legitimately can just live in like pretty much any moment at any time because of this tool that was given to her. Like, it's that high level thinking that we want from a science fiction movie. And it's, you know, this is one of those, like, if you really thought about it, you get into the spaceships and they start doing their designs and stuff. I mean, that's, you know, that's high budget stuff, but this is made like it's a low budget movie. Like, it's a lot of, you know, dark bunkers, dream sequences, human. That's not really how sci-fi generally goes. Like, this is more relatable to 10 Cloverfield Lane than it is to Interstellar.
Yeah. I think if Interstellar is this generation's 2001 A Space Odyssey, Arrival is this generation's Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
That's true. And this is better than Close Encounters of the
Third Kind. Oh, it's much better.
Much better. Close Encounters of the Third Kind does not hold up very well.
No.
In my opinion. I don't really like
Close Encounters. Like, Close Encounters is more like that kind of that journey that of discovery. And it's not quite as comparable as Interstellar and 2001 Space Odyssey, but it's the communication, right? Where in Close Encounters, they're communicating through music. And in here, we're communicating through writing and this understanding. That's what I really love about this film is I love the fact that science overcomes that militaristic opinion that the world has. And like, that's one of the biggest critiques this movie has is if we are always so antagonistic immediately and our response is to be antagonistic, we can miss out on this tool that will help us sustain life for millennia.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it though. The describing or communicating through music, communicating through writing. Like, yeah, I mean, this is 70s music made more sense. Writing makes more sense in 2016, I guess. This actually made me, though, while we were talking about that, it made me think of one thing that I didn't talk about with Interstellar. And because Arrival is shot in such a unique way and like, and like the storytelling is so unique. One thing with Interstellar too, that I wanted to mention that I didn't was the usage of the like documentary style at the beginning.
Yes.
That is a very interesting technique. That's something Reds did and When Harry Met Sally did. And that's a bold stance to start your movie with Ellen Bernstein sitting there talking. You don't know who this character is. And then we find out that it's kind of in that, you know, museum essentially. But I just think like Nolan and Villeneuve, they really still inflicted their style and creativity into these movies in ways that went beyond just the visuals and things like that. Like there's a lot of their stamp on these movies and they were still getting away with certain things that like a studio taking a chance on a huge science fiction epic might not normally want people to do. And so that was just something I thought about and didn't mention before and felt needed to be mentioned.
No, I agree. I think you watch Arrival, you know this is a Villeneuve film, if you've seen anything by Villeneuve, which I believe most of the world has now, between Dune and Blade Runner, or Sicario, because that's a totally different film genre. But yeah, it's definitely a Villeneuve film. It feels like it. Every shot, it's just like, oh, this is Villeneuve. And I love it. I absolutely love it. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that documentary style because that threw me off when I started watching Interstellar yesterday. I was like, oh, I don't remember this. And it's because it's not present throughout the film because it doesn't have anything to do with the back half of the film.
Well, and that's the thing. It's a red herring, much in the same way that the voiceover at the beginning of this movie is a red herring. Like there's and with the daughter, like they're red herrings that are thrown in there that don't really have an impact until you realize what they meant way later in the movie. And then they do have an impact, but it's way later in the movie. So I just thought that was, you know, it's sometimes the opening can really change your perspective when you sit down and watch a movie for a second, third, fourth time. Cause you're like, oh, that was right there for me this whole time.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of the opening, let's go back to this opening with Arrival, because I think this is one of the most, again, painful parts of this entire film. Louise's decision to go ahead with her relationship with Ian, have a child that she knows is going to die. And not just like knows is going to die, like we all know we're all going to die.
Yeah.
Knows is going to die at a young age. And decides to make that decision without Ian's knowledge of it. And that it, knowing that not telling Ian will result in him leaving her and like tearing everything apart. And that closing dialogue of, I'll always make this decision to do it. Because, like, it's better to have this time than not to have it.
Yeah.
Devastating.
Well, and that's like, you know, again, humanity in a nutshell a lot of the time, right? It's like, we all know that you have a kid, there's a chance that kid's going to die before you. We all know that. I mean, that is a legitimate possibility. I mean, in any way, shape, or form, that person can die. But you still do it anyway, because it's the joy that comes from it, you know, and that's why people just keep going on. I mean, that's why we don't just sit here and think about dying all the time, although some of us probably do. But, you know, like, yeah, I think that ending, that decision, that choice, even being able to see the future, it answers the question without blatantly stating, if you could see the future, would you change it? No,
yeah,
I wouldn't. Like I'd still do it the way that it was intended so that I could have these moments, because she knows how impactful that person's going to be on her life, even if it is only for a short time.
Yeah. It's, it's just so well scripted and so well acted and so emotional. It's a big impact that like these both of these movies had moments where I was crying in them. Maybe I'm just too much of a suck at this point, but
they're both emotional.
They're both emotional. My question for you before we close everything off with these two films, did these two films coming out in such close succession make it almost impossible for science fiction movies to be original science fiction movies to be made from then on up?
I mean, we haven't seen any in recent years that have really come close to these, unless I'm forgetting some. But you know,
we've had a couple blockbusters because we had the Blade Runner sequel, which again not original.
Yeah,
and we finally got a Dune adaptation that wasn't David Lynch,
but also not original.
Yeah,
and so, it's Villeneuve. So
yeah, and it's still Villeneuve. So does it really count? Actually, both of those are Villeneuve. So yeah,
so they really don't count. I just think like. Yeah, it's kind of like you just talked about The Mummy earlier. Like that movie kind of like broke that genre because then if everything was being compared to that. Now, if you're going to make a science fiction epic, you have to make something that's the caliber of Interstellar or Arrival. Like you have to. You can't get away with making trash because these are expensive movies and there's an expectation that comes with it. Like a visual and a storytelling perspective and the actors you attach. If you think about the actors that are attached to these two movies, you have nothing but Oscar winners and Oscar nominees. I mean, Michael Caine's in what, 10 minutes of Interstellar. He won two Oscars, two-time Oscar winner. Like all of these people are just Oscar winners, Oscar nominees, saturating this stuff. And, you know, even if it was preemptive, I mean, Jessica Chastain and Casey Affleck hadn't won Oscars by 2014, but they certainly did after that. Yeah. So it like there's such a quality that is necessary now when making these. And you can't just make a Michael Bay type movie anymore. Like you can't do that and have a science fiction blockbuster. You have to be a superhero movie or you have to be like insanely, insanely highbrow sci-fi. Otherwise, you're not getting made. And I just think that's where we're at.
Yeah, I mean, I think the closest thing we've had since these movies came out was probably Annihilation, which we discussed previously. Was the closest thing to like a science fiction, but it's still not on the caliber of the
that Ex Machina. Like, but they're not.
Yeah,
but grand scale like things, and no. Neither one of them really made that much money, right? If I'm not mistaken.
No, they're more cult followings than anything else.
Yeah. Which is where Alex Garland's just always going to be. So it's like, but anyway, you got anything else you want to say about either of these movies?
Science fiction's fun.
Yeah, science
fiction's fun. I do wish there was more science fiction to talk about. Good thing there's more next week.
Yeah, there is. We're talking about Planet of the Apes from 1968, not the god-awful, godforsaken, whatever the hell Tim Burton made movie. Talking about Planet of the Apes from 1968 and Birdman from 2014. So that's our number 25. We're into the top 25. 25 weeks left of this. That means we won't be done in 25 weeks. We got to keep going. But 25 weeks left of this. So, so make sure to watch The Right Planet of the Apes. Watch Birdman. And, you know, there's only one Birdman, so just watch that one too. And that's it. That's all I got. Thank you all for listening.
Actually, I do want to take a moment before we sign off, though. End of Evangelion's coming up in a few weeks. I think it's like 7 weeks from now or something like that. Now's your time to start watching Evangelion so you can watch End of Evangelion.
I'm almost done. I have like 4 episodes left.
And then watch the rebuild after you watch End of Evangelion because it deserves to be watched. But now's the time. I'm giving you 7 weeks to prepare and watch this 26-episode show before this.
They're all 20 minutes long. They're very short. I really do. I have like 4 or 5 episodes left. I couldn't tell you the name of any of their characters or anything, but I have 4 or 5 episodes left. Yeah. Anime, man. It does for some people. I actually like the show, but it doesn't do it for others. All right. Anyway, see everybody next week.